Radio.
All right, you're something's not happening with the weather. I don't know what it is.
For the better.
I'm kind of liking it, though. It's a strange trend, isn't it? It seems like it's rain and it's rainy and it's humid all week long during the work week.
Perfect.
And then, like, the weekend rolls around and it suddenly becomes totally beautiful. And here it is, Friday at 5 p.m. and the sun came out about an hour ago, shining down on us, which is pretty awesome. So here comes the weekend. Congratulations. Time for American Hit Radio on 90.3 WHPC. We are here every Wednesday and Friday for Triple Happy Hour.
Triple.
You can imagine that if you're thinking about, well, 5 p.m. is one thing, Friday 5 p.m. and a beautiful Friday at that. I'll just take it.
And it's the solstice.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Longest day of the year. So there you go. Quadruple Happy Hour. And of course, we're bringing you our Who series. We're up to part 38. In our coverage of the Who, and we're at a strange time in their history. Last week, we covered Pete Townshend's first genuine solo album, Empty Glass, and we're going to pick up with what was happening after that. And, you know, at the dawn of the 80s, the Who, even though they'd been touring a lot, and they brought in Kenny Jones, and they were, you know, the people were raving about the shows, the band seemed to be struggling to remain as vital as they once were. Now, punk rock had obviously usurped most of the relevance from classic rock bands, and the loss of Keith Moon left the permanent impression, really, that things could never really be the same as they once were. Now, on top of that, Pete and Roger and John were placing a lot of emphasis on their solo careers, which further diluted the strength of the band's image. So from all sides, this was a rocky era for The Who, made only worse when certain events began to unfold, which we'll get into as as we get into the show. Now, last week I mentioned that we played Pete Townshend's Empty Glass album. We didn't have time for one specific track, the last track on the album. And I want to get that track in today because it was the song that got most of the airplay on FM. It wasn't a hit single, but it was the song that FM grabbed. I remember that I loved that album. If you were listening last week, I certainly made it clear how much I love the album Empty Glass. But for some reason, the song Gonna Get You, I always thought that that was like the black sheep of the album. It was the one song where Pete sounded like he was trying to write in a formulaic way rather than writing something which was deeply personal, because it is a very personal album up to this track. And this track just sounded like, yeah, these are the words that I would write if I wanted to write a hit. It didn't necessarily mean anything. But the song itself, as I said, made the Who fans happy. It was probably the most Who-like thing on his album. So here it is then, Gonna Get You on 90.3 WHBC. All right. Taken from the album Empty Glass, which was actually causing some problems among The Who. What happened was, I mean, the album was selling like hotcakes. It was an incredible success, deservedly so. It was a truly great album. And The Who felt that they were more or less touring to support the solo album. And John and Roger both complained about it from time to time, which, like, shut up. You know, Pete wrote songs for you guys for 15 years, gave you all wonderful careers, and he put out a solo album, and he's touring with the band. It seems to me like it was an inappropriate complaint to say that the guy who was, like, writing all of their songs would be releasing a solo album, coincidentally, on top of it, while The Who were out touring. Now, for an interesting point of comparison, though, a year after Townsend released Empty Glass, John Entwistle released a solo album called Too Late the Hero. And he dropped a great deal of, like, the real heavy, weird, dark humor that he was known for. He still managed to, you know, try to keep a sense of humor in his songs. But he was working with people like Joe Walsh on the album, and he was just trying to make something that might have been a bit more professional. And the album had a bit of a veneer like that. That being said, there was one song on the album, it's called Dancing Master. And I just heard it recently in order to do this show. And when I heard it, I thought to myself, doesn't that sort of resemble the Pete Townsend song Gonna Get Ya? So I don't know. Let's find out what you think. Let's play them back to back, since we're going to get there before by show's end anyway, to get back to John Entwistle's album. Let's just see if you see a passing resemblance between this track and the one that we just heard by Pete. Here's John Entwistle from Too Late the Hero with Dancing Master.
Whether you like bust into that shiny piece of black plastic. I'm the dancing master.
I mean, of course, it's got a lot more bass. It's more of a disco track than a rock track.
Yes.
But it's got like a similar chord structure to the one. I just said, boy, I wonder if it just seems like he might have subconsciously been like listening to Pete's song and thinking that, you know, he could maybe take
I'm
off
sure
from
that
with one of his own.
Time.
Right. I'm sure it does, too. Now, OK, this is an excerpt from Pete's autobiography called Who I Am from around this era. The third date of the tour was at the Riverfront Stadium in Cincinnati on December 3rd, 1979, where we played our usual show. On stage with the band, I was often quite delirious with enjoyment, which was completely new for me. I had never enjoyed performing as much as I did on this tour. I was drinking a lot, that's true, even on stage, and smoking, that too is true, and of course I danced. Maybe I did dance like a fool. Who cares? I was inspired. I often made disastrous musical mistakes on stage, but I was stretching the boundaries and taking huge chances with extemporizations. Kenny struggled to keep up sometimes, but always gave me a solid rock bed. Rabbit was always right with me, often taking the lead. John did what he always did. Unflappable, he was always totally in tune with whatever I did. I often played astonishingly outlandish passages, and sometimes when I ad-libbed on stage, I cooked up lyrics that I wrote down later and used for new songs. All this freewheeling was understandably tough for Roger, though, making it tricky for him to fit in with our musical digressions. I kept taking over the lead microphone and kicking off new songs. My adrenaline on stage was running so high most nights I couldn't control myself. Well, after the show at the Riverfront, we assembled in the band's dressing room, but Bill, our manager, had terrible news. "Something terrible happened out there tonight," he said. 11 kids have died. I don't know the exact details." "When did this happen?" someone asked. "During the show? In the crowd?" "No," Bill tried to calm us. "It was at the entrances on the plaza outside." "Before the show?" I got on my feet. "We decided not to tell you," he said. "The crowd couldn't be allowed to leave the building while security was still dealing with the trouble outside." Back at the hotel, we all gathered in a meeting room and watched the television. Some of us were weeping at the images of bodies laid out, reminiscent of a mass shooting. We didn't say much. We had a few drinks, but I was already numb. It turned out that 11 fans were killed, and many more injured, in the rush for seating. The concert was sold out, and when the crowds waiting outside in the cold heard us performing the sound check, they assumed the concert had started and stampeded. Those at the front were trampled to death by those pushing from behind who hadn't realized that the doors were still closed. Terrible story. Taken from another perspective, Richard Barnes from his own book, Maximum R&B, recounts it like this. "Because of the first-come, first-served basis of general admission seating, a large crowd had already formed outside the Coliseum by 1:30 in the afternoon. By 6:30, it had grown to around 8,000, and there were only 25 police on duty to control it. It was already getting out of hand, as those at the back were pushing forward and appeals to the police to do something were ignored. People were falling down in the crush and getting trampled. However, when the doors were opened, it appears that only two of the four doors were opened out of 16. Two or four doors were opened out of 16. The authorities afterwards claimed that more doors were opened, but eyewitnesses denied it vehemently. The kids who died were squeezed by the enormous crush of the crowd and simply couldn't breathe. The crowd trampled over bodies that had dropped to the ground while being caught in the surge to get in through the few open doors. All this time, ticket takers inside insisted on seeing people's tickets. The Inquirer the next day reported a stampede. And the Dayton, Ohio Journal-Herald reported one of the doormen is saying, first they threw a bottle through a window in the door about 2 minutes before the gates were to open. Then they pushed through the hole, making it bigger. Three or four of us tried to hold them back. They carried in one boy and laid him out on a table, and he died. The same newspaper quoted an eyewitness who said he'd tried to revive three of the victims. People just didn't seem to care. They could see the people all piled up, and the crowd still refuted the media suggestions of a stampede. Rolling Stone reported one of them getting angry at the word stampede because to him it was a concentration of too many people in too small a space with nowhere to go but forward. The band did decide to continue the tour, basically to in honor of those that had died. They dedicated the next night's show to the family members that they lost, as they put it. And later on, they finished the year playing one of the concerts for the people of Kampuchea at London's Hammersmith Odeon with a very drunk and funny Pete Townsend, you know, returning on the last night of the Kampuchea concerts to play in Paul McCartney's rockestra, as he called it, along with 18 other rock stars who were all, except for Pete, much to Paul's annoyance, wearing gold lamé top hats and tails. Here's a track from Concert for Kampuchea, The Who, playing their classic hit, Baba O'Reilly.
Together before.
live at the Concerts for the People of Kampuchea, put on by Paul McCartney and a whole bunch of bands. The Who, when the album was released, took up all of side one from the album dedicated that was taken from that concert. Again, taken from Richard Barnes' book, though, about the tour. Kenny had complained to me about, meaning Richard Barnes, about the during the tour, that he didn't like touring while Pete's album was out. Roger and John were not happy, too, at the thought of the band working to help a solo album. Empty Glass, the first release on the relaunched Atco label, had been a big seller for a solo effort. It was selling much more than ever anticipated and had reached number 8 in Billboard and was staying there. The second single, Let My Love Open the Door, had taken off and climbed well up the charts and was one of a handful of singles to achieve over 1 million airplays in the USA during 1980. This was a very, you know, productive time for Pete Townsend. So much so that he had some great songs, like pretty much hidden on the shelving at his Eel Pie Studios. And some of them were quite good that never made the album. So I want to play this track. I don't think it came out until he started releasing his demos in groups. This is one of them. This is called Mary on 90.3 WHPC. A demo from around this same time in the early 80s from Pete Townsend. Now, at this time, I mentioned that the single Let My Love Open the Door was selling well. I remember it had a picture sleeve on it, and the B-side had two tracks on the B-side of the 45 of the 7-inch single. And so usually that's not a good sign. It usually means that they're just going to be small toss-offs that the artist didn't really need. I fell in love with those two tracks. Pete Townsend became my hero in the early 80s. It seemed like everything that he did just astounded me. And these songs, to this day, I don't know if you're going to recognize them. They almost never got any airplay, and they went totally, you know, pretty much ignored by the media. But I love them. The first track is called Classified, and it sounds like a simple little song about a guy reading the paper. And as the song goes on, you realize that what he's doing is he's actually looking to adopt a child. And it's deeply moving, and it's so beautiful the way that the song begins to build up to a crescendo. The same thing with its follow-up called Greyhound Girl. We'll play them both right now, back-to-back. From the B-side of the Let My Love Open the Door single, here is Classified. I'm sorry, yes, Classified on 90.3 WHBC.
When I've nothing else to do, I find me a paper. I take it on up to my room. You'll find me there later, reading the classified. Classified, looking. When I've nothing else to do, I buy me a paper. I take it on up to my room. You find me there later, reading the classified. Thank you.
Little songs, but they, I don't know, I love them. They just move me, both of them, very much. That was Classified and Greyhound Girl. I don't know where else they're available except for on that single, Let My Love Open the Door. I don't know if they were released anywhere else. My original versions were incredibly noisy because my single got played a lot. They sound a little odd there, and in fact, going over the air, perhaps. Well, again, let's see, around this time in the spring of this year, around of 1980, McVicar, starring Roger Daltrey, was premiered in London. Roger had been working with the band's manager, Bill Kirbishley, trying to get McVicar off of the ground for 3 years. Bill and Jackie Kirbishley, his wife, of course, originally read part of bank robber John McVicar's life story in the Sunday Times, not reading the classifieds. Well, it would be, McVicar was still serving his 23-year sentence. They thought it would be a good role for Roger, but it took some time to raise the money. But by putting up the future profits from a soundtrack album, which was supposed to be written and played by The Who as collateral, Polydor agreed to put up the money. In the event, Pete didn't write anything for the album, and The Who did play, but only session parts. However, the soundtrack album sold very well. The film received a lot of bad reviews in England, but it was still a number one box office success. Here, then, are a couple of tracks from that album, starting with this, the opening track called Bitter and Twisted from the album McVicar on 90.3 WHBC.
Screwed up mind. Don't come in. businessman puts a shaky hand through the space beneath the wall.
It's a twist
where a lonely queen is a sex machine just to answer nature's call.
It's a twist.
The first man's wife holds a kitchen knife, but she can't stand the sight of blood.
It's a twist.
So she takes her pills and he's always ill, and they both dream of superstars.
Without your love. where would I be?
That track is called Without Your Love. It was the single from the album McVicker. Some Who fans actually looked at that album almost as though it was a Who album because all four members played on it. It's Entwistle on bass and, of course, Pete contributed guitar, Kenny Jones played drums, but none of them wrote anything, so it really had nothing at all to do with it being a Who album. Meanwhile, I just have one other small masterpiece from Pete Townshend from this era. Again, like I said, I was totally enamored with the man at this point in time, and there were like little things that came out that I don't think many Who fans are aware of, that they exist, like that B-side of that single that we played earlier. And this song, I don't even think that real dedicated Pete Townshend fans are necessarily aware of this next track. It really is just something that he is a producer on, but because it's credited, he's credited as the producer, but he obviously wrote the song. It's obviously his fabulous guitar work on the record, and he sings background vocals while letting a little girl, an 11-year-old girl named Angie, sing the lead part. It turns out that Angie was, I just found this out, one of the girls that sang on the Buggles video Killed the Radio Star. She doesn't sound like she's actually a bit much of a star voice or anything, but it's such an appealing record. It's just so easy to fall in love with this track. Song basically Pete writing it from the perspective of an 11-year-old girl about family life. And I just love it. Here then, credited to Angie is this wonderful, rare single called Peppermint Lump on 90.3 WHPC.
Mother gets up at 8, falls out of bed, splashes his face, scratches his head. He runs down the stairs to me and my sister in the kitchen with Mum. Sometimes he smiles, sometimes he don't, just drinks up his tea and eats up his toast. But when I feel sad, he always tells me to look for the sun.
Don't you worry, be happy, Peppermint Lump. Now don't you worry, be happy, Peppermint Lump. Now don't you worry, be happy, Peppermint Lump.
We get in his car, he pulls out the choke. We drive up the street in a cloud of blue smoke. At the junction, we queue up to join the traffic jam. After a bit, he gets us to school. 3 minutes late, he's always the rule. And waving goodbye, he drives off to work as a minicab man.
Don't you worry, simple, so simple, it's simple, it's simple, so simple, so important.
Thank you.
fabulous little rarity there called Peppermint Lump, credited to Angie, of course, the work of Pete Townsend on that one. A rare 45. I think you can get it. There's a couple of CDs called the Stiff Singles. You might be able to find it on there if you look hard enough, because that's not easy to find either. Meanwhile, as I mentioned, John Entwistle had been working on his album for quite some time with Joe Walsh and Joe Vitale. The Who and the Eagles had to come before solo projects, so it was difficult for them to find mutually convenient recording time. John says that he and Walsh only managed to spend 2 months together in the 2 years that it took to make the album. Besides playing his usual bass guitar, John handled the synthesizers and piano on the album. "So I was actually really pleased with the album," John said when Too Late the Hero finally came out in September of 1981. "I was stuck in the black humor bag for a long time. I felt very limited. Now the songs are humorous, but not in the same way. Now I write songs about love, sex, and drugs, same as everybody else." We'll leave you with this track, and this is the title song from John Entwistle's album, Too Late the Hero. Thanks for listening, folks. Enjoy this fabulous weekend, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Can't control the situation. This show.